From PRI, Public Radio International.
She moved a rather threadbare fur coat, which smelled badly of mothballs. Underneath it was a walking stick and a water-stained copy of Romance and Legend of Chivalry by A.R. Hope Moncrief, priced at 5 pence. Next to the book on its side was the Holy Grail.
You're listening to Jane Curtin reading from Chivalry by Neil Gaiman, which we'll hear later on this edition of Selected Shorts, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. As all you literary listeners know, there has often in history been a connection between restaurants, bars, and cafes, and the writers who hang out in these places and even create their best work there. You've read about Les Deux Magots on the left bank in Paris, where Sartre and de Beauvoir held court, or the Mermaid Tavern in London, where Chris Marlowe and Bill Shakespeare were among the regulars. But right here in New York City, we were able to stage a program of stories by writers whose artistic home is the beloved Hungarian Pastry Shop on Amsterdam Avenue near Columbia University, a place often filled with members of the Columbia Graduate Writing Program and programs at nearby schools, all tapping away, creating great fiction on their laptops. There were no mentions of strudel or Hungarian rugelach in any of the stories, but let's listen now to one of the stories, What Happened Between Us, by Rivka Galchin, read by Jonathan Hadari.
One unusually rainy evening when I was home early with a migraine, a woman entered my apartment who looked exactly like my wife, Rima. I watched this woman close the door behind herself casually. Peering over the edge of Rima's pale blue leather shoulder bag, that's what this other woman was carrying, was a russet puppy. The real Rima doesn't like dogs. A hay feverishly fresh scent of Rima's shampoo was filling the air yellowly, and through the brashness of that grassy scent, I squinted at the simulacrum and at that small dog, acknowledging to myself only a deep sense that something was extraordinarily wrong. Yes, extraordinarily wrong. It was those words precisely that came to me, turning up unexpectedly like an old movie stub found in the pocket of a coat not worn for years. The doppelganger's hair obscured her face somewhat as she leaned down to de-shoe, but I could see, same unzipping of wrinkly boots, same taking off of same baby blue coat with oversized charcoal buttons, same tucking behind ears of dyed corn silk blonde hair, same bangs, cut straight across like on those dolls done up in native costumes that live their whole lives in plastic cases held up by a metal wire around the waist. Same everything, but it wasn't Rima. How I knew? Just a feeling. But what is a feeling but a thought groping its way towards articulation? Like the moment near the end of a dream when I am sometimes able to whisper to myself, I am dreaming. I remember once waking up from a dream in which my mother, dead now for decades, was sipping tea at my kitchen table, reading a newspaper, on the back of which there was a headline, Wrong Man, Right Name, Convicted in Murder Trial. I was trying to read the smaller print of the article, but my mother kept moving the paper, readjusting, turning pages. When I woke up, I searched all through the house for that newspaper and through the garbage outside as well, but I never found it. Oh, the doppelganger said quietly, seeming to notice the dimmed lights. I'm sorry. Her imitation of Rima's girlish Argentine accent was pitch perfect. You're not well? She was holding that lean russet puppy up against her chest. The puppy was trembling. Then the woman began a remarkable imitation of Rima's slightly irregularly rhythmed walk across the room, past me, into the kitchen. I heard her set the tea kettle to boil. You look odd, I found myself saying to the woman I could no longer see. Yes, a dog, she sing-songed happily from the kitchen. She began to speak at length, maybe about the dog, maybe not. I couldn't quite concentrate. She said something about Chinatown. Not seeing her, just hearing her voice and the rhythm of her customary evasions made it seem like she really was my Rima. But this strange look-alike woman, when she kissed my forehead, I blushed. I'm sorry about yesterday, she said with a pout. I'm sorry, I was making theater, which was a Rima turn of phrase. I covered my eyes with my hands so I wouldn't have to look at her. My migraine winced and pulsed as if in time with that grassy-scented shampoo that always makes my head feel tinny. I didn't want to think what I was thinking. I began thinking, how can I stop thinking these thoughts? I'm too old for, I thought, trying to break the other inarticulate thoughts with my workaday psychiatrist thoughts, and too young for, but I suppose when something truly unforeseen happens, it can only be realized iteratively, in retrospect, gaining in reality one facet at a time. Monster, the woman whispered loudly, which is Rima's pet name for me. I don't think, I said suddenly, surprised by my own words, you're Rima. You're mad with me? No, I said and turned to hide my face in the sofa's cushions. I'm sorry, I mumbled to the small weave wool of the cushion's covering. And when I felt a hand on my shoulder, I feel so rainy today, I whispered. It must be the tired. By the time the water neared its boil, the ascending pitches of our tea kettle's tremble are so familiar to me. I was considering a diagnosis of migraine-induced psychosis. Or if not migraine psychosis, then I'd settle for simply the catch-all psychotic disorder, NOS, not otherwise specified, which I hoped over time would reveal itself to be that ineffable but essentially harmless imp, a brief psychotic episode. All this oversimplified diagnostic nonsense I offer simply because I'd like to emphasize that I began this investigation trying to impose many of the same theories that others are still considering, though now, of course, with a better understanding of the evidence, I've moved beyond those confining thoughts. Around 2 a.m., the woman asleep with the dog in her arms, their breathing synchronous, I found myself searching through Rima's pale blue purse that smelled only very, very faintly of dog. But when I noticed what I was doing, unfolding credit card receipts, breathing in the scent of her change purse, licking the powder off a half-open stick of gum, I felt like a cuckolded husband in an old movie. It was as if I was expecting to find theater tickets or a monogrammed cigarette case or a bottle of arsenic. And that is to say, because I could not even conceive of a reasonable explanation for the ersatz Rima, I found myself turning to cheap and banal fictions for hypotheses. Why does even my imagination humiliate me when the world sufficiently accomplishes the task unaided? I should like to clarify that just because Rima is so much younger than me, just because I didn't necessarily know at every moment exactly where she was, or what precisely in Spanish she said over the telephone to people who I might very well have been perfect strangers with and whom I never asked about, just because of these very normal facets of our relationship, it is still not necessarily likely, not at all, that Rima is or was in love with some or many other people. And isn't this all irrelevant anyway? Why would infidelities lead to disappearances? Or to dog appearances? I took Rima's pale blue purse and left. As I walked the dewy night, I counted backwards from 100 by sevens. I asked myself if I knew what it meant, the phrase, a rolling stone gathers no moss. I wondered to myself what I might do if I were to find an unmailed letter on the ground, and it comforted me to realize that I would either open it or put it in a mailbox, or both, all of which were acceptable answers. Basically, I was administering to myself a modified mini mental exam, and I was doing, by the way, just fine. In that way, anyway. Soon I find myself walking along Bourbon Street, still crowded at that hour, I imagine, with tourists, mostly men, whom I imagined were sailors on leave, though I saw no one in a uniform, except for a woman who was dancing in a window box and whose sailor outfit was half mesh. The cursive R of a Ripley's Believe It or Not museum reflected against the glass and against her skin with varied refraction. I found I wanted to stop and look at her as if she might possibly be Rima. But just then two other men, boys really, stopped there, and I did not want to be part of a crowd, and so I walked on. When I was first with Rima, my ears would grow hot and my blood pressure would rise if I saw a man chatting up a woman in line at a store, as if any woman being hit on anywhere revealed the sexually corrupt souls of millions of men I did not know who might one day steal Rima away from me. I used to carry beta blockers just to make it through my day. But I had been better of late. I had not had to take one for months, maybe almost a year. "Are you cold?" I heard a woman's voice say, but I turned and it was clear she was not talking to me. Often on Bourbon Street, I hear one visitor pedanting to another about how in New Orleans the graves are above ground on account of the water table being so high. All these people feeling so singular, learning the same small fact again and again. One window box had no woman, just cold light, peeling paint walls, something blue and silky on the floor. The glass showed a shimmery ghost parade, like an old television screen, of passersby. I found myself walking to the box, imagining one of the walls to be false, to be hiding a woman or a rabbit behind it. I put my face up against the glass, hands at the side of my face so as to see past the mirroring surface. Someone's hand, not my hand, went into the back pocket of my pants. And a moony voice, not my voice, said, "What are you looking for?" "I don't know," I said, not because I didn't want to say I was looking for my wife, but because I was so startled. He laughed. I saw it was a he, a very tall he with a Roman nose and strangely familiar when I turned around. I found myself clutching Rima's purse, which I'd forgotten I was carrying, as if he were going to steal it. But when he reached toward me, it was not towards the purse. Instead, he put a hand gently to my cheek. "Am I feverish?" I asked. "Do you like powdered donuts?" he asked. I found myself saying no. Then I said no again. He said okay and walked away. I reached my own hand up to my own cheek to the same place where he had touched me, and I thought that maybe it was me who was not myself, that maybe it was me who had been replaced. When I returned home, I put Rima's pale blue shoulder bag underneath the sink for safekeeping. It was 5 a.m., and my new house guest was not yet awake. I peered in at where she was sleeping, but she was hidden beneath Rima's ugly old yellow quilt, with only one indefinite tan arm and a few trickles of blonde hair showing. It was a little bit uncanny, the feeling I had looking at her. Leaving the sleeping simulacrum to herself, I lay down myself alone on the sofa, experiencing the unhappy deja vu of having lain myself down in just the same way 12 hours earlier, expecting my Rima's imminent arrival. I tried to rest, but although the phone did not ring, our phone of late rings terribly often but frequently disconnects after I say hello. Intrusive thoughts rising as if carbonated disturbed me from my sleep. A movie dimly recalled from childhood with a blind samurai whose doppelganger pursues him. John Donne meeting his wife's doppelganger in Paris and this portending his baby's death. Maupassant seeing his own doppelganger and it portending his own death. A bruise on the back of Rima's knee. And a hand in my back pocket. This is just a problem, I told myself. Probably just a very normal problem masquerading as a strange one. an ordinary problem, pretending to be extraordinary. I don't know if I thought it then, but I was thinking it just now about how my mother used to say that almost any problem could be solved by one of the following three solutions: a warm bath, a hot drink, or what she called going to the bathroom, though she never specified what was to be done in there, and sometimes I would just go there to think. I can't really recall a time in my childhood when that didn't work. Our bathtub was in the middle of our kitchen, and the bathroom was a thin-walled room just the other side of the kitchen sink. Both rooms had the same houndstooth hand-laid tile floor, and one always heard water coursing through the pipes or breaking or boiling. That's just something I was thinking about. I feel like I should report these seemingly irrelevant thoughts just on the off chance that they're important in a way I don't immediately understand. The possible significance of whatever comes to mind. That's one of the few precepts of psychoanalysis that I don't consider utterly foolish. The sound of painfully familiar sock footing about woke me from what couldn't have been much more than an hour of sleep, but an awkward hour, from which I woke with a numb and tingly left hand that I prodded experimentally until it returned with star-bursting hurt back to life. I'd suffered a dream in which what was happening to me was exactly what was actually happening to me, but because I woke up with a sense of relief, I had the clawing hope that Rima's disappearance had been not also, but only in my dream, had been induced simply by indigestion or a cold draft or a foot cramp. But then I was being lavished with affection from that russet dog. I don't understand where this came from, I said aloud, I think. But I heard Rima's voice coming from the kitchen and a tea kettle being set to boil. Yes, it was really Rima's voice. Strange dog in the house, but Rima's voice. A relaxation started right at the base of my shoulder blades, tracing down in swathes. Meanwhile, that dog had taken a hold of my loose sock with its teeth and was shaking its head back and forth. Such behavior may appear playful, but it's quite clearly a component of the instinct that breaks the neck of caught prey. Yet we call it cute. It's just like how we have so successfully forgotten as a species that a smile was born as a masking afterthought to the sudden baring of teeth. You feel better, Rima's voice said. But when I turned, I saw her, the simulacrum of my true love. And when I saw her, well, I smiled. She was the same. Despite the voice, the same. Same false vision of Rima from before. And yes, I kind of hated her, the stranger. The dog makes you happy, the substitute continued. And what could I answer except, no. The dog then left me for her. She picked the dog up in her arms. She told me she didn't care what I thought about what to name the dog, that she was going to name her without me. I said I didn't care what she named the dog who was licking her face with dedication. But I got this dog, she said to me, for you. The dog had dark, wet eyes. The woman's eyes were similar. And then I noticed that she, the woman, had fine lines of age on her face, tiny crow's feet. And not just when she smiled, since I could see the lines right then and she was not smiling. The lookalike Rima, I began to realize, was not such a perfect lookalike. It would seem Rima was being played by someone older, or who at least looked older. Someone pretty, but not as pretty. Not that there's anything wrong with an older woman. There is nothing wrong with women my age, for example. I just don't happen to be married to one. You said dogs are brilliant, she said. You said Freud's dogs could diagnose the patients. And it struck me to wonder, was Rima kidnapped? Or did she willingly leave? Which would be worse? I was determined not to let my voice crack, and that is part of the reason why I was trying to avoid speaking. Fortunately, the doppelganger seemed to have the same talent as Rima for filling up silent spaces, and she went on. You said Freud's dogs knew when therapy was over and knew who was psychotic and who was neurotic and that when memories were recovered, the dog would wag its tail. You said you would have liked to have such insight, such dog insight. that it would be better than your own. And I listen to you because that is something that I do. And here I go against my own instincts and get us this beautiful dog in order to please you and to help us to bring a little bit of life into this home. And from you, I get nothing but silence and strangeness. And you're looking at me like I'm green or dead. Why? Why do you look at me like that? The russet puppy, I mean dog, was licking tears from the doppelganger's face. But Freud's dogs were chow dogs, I said. It was all I could think of to say. Looking at her, at this ever so slightly older Rima, feeling a dimness advancing from the base of my skull, I turned away from this woman and went to the bathroom, where I ran hot water over my hands, which is something I like to do in the colder months. It's something that I just makes me feel a little bit better. Then I touch my face with my warmed hands. This is something I do to calm down. It's just this very normal thing that I do. Over the sound of the running water, I could hear Rima's voice calling through the door. She was not pleased. I was thinking, does Rima know this twin of hers? Did Rima complain about me to her? There were difficult aspects of Rima, I can't deny that. A lot of this arguing through a bathroom door had been going on in the time before her disappearance, though the details of these arguments are unimportant, especially since now that she is gone, those difficulties, those details, well, it's almost impossible to remember what they were. The Rima-like voice came through the door with something about being tired of it always being her getting stuck with the label of being unreasonable, irrational, crazy. I thought to shout back that, of course, it was her getting stuck with that label, and that, furthermore, I'd only ever said irrational and unreasonable and never crazy, and that it was she alone who was assigning normative values to those labels. And listen, she couldn't even let a man just wash his hands in peace. But I stopped myself, instead said nothing, thinking to myself, this fight is stupid. This fight is ridiculous. And to have it with a woman I don't even know, that is even more ridiculous. Older, wrong, and no more manageable, this replacement wife. And I admit the thought briefly crossed my mind, I don't want anyone at all. Some people will think they've perceived something ugly here between the lines. But I believe there are those who will recognize my situation, notwithstanding its deceivingly eccentric particulars, for what it truly is. Let me be clear. It is not I who misunderstands the significance of a night nurse, or of a dog who appears to be a puppy, or of unspeaking callers, or of a man who does not know his leg is missing, or of another man whose apology has taken on a life of its own. It is not the wrong movie whose ticket I have in my pocket, whose plot I have forgotten. But I don't care. Let them have her. I had to leave, of course, because my love is faithful, because I love only the original Rima. And I'm certain that I will find her. I know that what is extraordinarily wrong often returns to itself as something simply extraordinary.
After a brief pause, we'll be back with the wonderful Jane Curtin reading a story about a lady and a knight in shining armor. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide, from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. I don't know why, but I'm just a sucker for stories in which characters from another century suddenly appear in contemporary surroundings. That's why I'm so fond of the story you're about to hear, Chivalry by Neil Gaiman. in which a certain knight in shining armor turns up in a London neighborhood on the trail of a certain grail that he has heard might be found there. Neil Gaiman has been one of the top writers in modern comics for more than 20 years and is now a best-selling novelist. His story collections include Fragile Things and M is for Magic. He's the author of the children's book Coraline, now a feature film, and the Newbery Award-winning children's novel The Graveyard Book. Reading his story, Chivalry, at the lovely Mehewi Theater in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, is the stage and screen star Jane Curtin.
Mrs. Whittaker found the Holy Grail. It was under a fur coat. Every Thursday afternoon, Mrs. Whittaker walked down to the post office to collect her pension, even though her legs were no longer what they were. And on the way back home, she would stop in at the Oxfam shop and buy herself a little something. The Oxfam shop sold old clothes, knick-knacks, oddments, bits and bobs, and large quantities of old paperbacks, all of them donations, second-hand flotsam, often the house clearances of the dead. All the profits went to charity. The shop was staffed by volunteers. The volunteer on duty this afternoon was Marie, 17, slightly overweight, and dressed in a baggy mauve jumper that looked like she had bought it from the shop. Marie sat by the till with a copy of Modern Woman magazine, filling out a Reveal Your Hidden Personality questionnaire. Every now and then, she'd flip back to the back of the magazine and check the relative points assigned to an A, B, or C answer before making up her mind how she'd respond to the question. Mrs. Whittaker puttered around the shop. They still hadn't sold the stuffed cobra, she noted. It had been there for 6 months now, gathering dust, glass eyes gazing balefully at the clothes racks, and the cabinet filled with chipped porcelain and chewed toys. Mrs. Whittaker patted its head as she went past. She picked out a copy of Mills and Boone novels from a bookshelf, Her Thundering Soul and Her Turbulent Heart, a shilling each, and gave careful consideration to the empty bottle of Matus Rosé with a decorative lampshade on it before deciding she really didn't have anywhere to put it. She moved a rather threadbare fur coat, which smelled badly of mothballs. Underneath it was a walking stick and a water-stained copy of Romance and Legend of Chivalry by A.R. Hope Moncrief, priced at 5 pence. Next to the book on its side was the Holy Grail. It had a little round paper sticker on the base, and written on it in felt pen was the price. 30p. Mrs. Whittaker picked up the dusty silver goblet and appraised it through her thick spectacles. "This is nice," she called to Marie. Marie shrugged. "It'd look nice on the mantelpiece." Marie shrugged again. Mrs. Whittaker gave 50 pence to Marie, who gave her 10 pence change in a brown paper bag to put the books and the Holy Grail in. Then she went next door to the butcher's and bought herself a nice piece of liver. Then she went home. The inside of the goblet was thickly coated with a brownish-red dust. Mrs. Whittaker washed it out with great care, then left it in to soak for an hour in warm water with a dash of vinegar added. Then she polished it with metal polish until it gleamed, and she put it on the mantelpiece in her parlor, where it sat between a small, soulful China basset hound and a photograph of her late husband Henry on the beach at Frinton in 1953. She had been right. It did look nice. For dinner that evening, she had the liver fried in breadcrumbs with onions. It was very nice. The next morning was Friday. On alternate Fridays, Mrs. Whittaker and Mrs. Greenberg would visit each other. Today it was Mrs. Greenberg's turn to visit Mrs. Whittaker. They sat in the parlor and ate macaroons and drank tea. Mrs. Whittaker took one sugar in her tea, but Mrs. Greenberg took sweetener, which she always carried in her handbag in a small plastic container.
"That's nice,"
said Mrs. Greenberg, pointing to the Grail.
What is it? It's the Holy Grail, said Mrs. Whittaker. It's the cup that Jesus drank out of at the Last Supper. Later at the crucifixion, it caught his precious blood when the centurion's spear pierced his side.
Mrs. Greenberg sniffed. She was small and Jewish and didn't hold with unsanitary things.
I wouldn't know about that, she said. But it's very nice. Our Myron got one just like that when he won the swimming tournament. Only it's got his name on the side. Is he still with that nice girl, the hairdresser? Bernice? Oh, yes. They're thinking of getting engaged, said Mrs. Greenberg. That's nice, said Mrs. Whittaker. She took another macaroon.
Mrs. Greenberg baked her own macaroons and brought them over every alternate Friday. Small, sweet, light brown biscuits with almonds on top. They talked about Myron and Bernice and Mrs. Whittaker's nephew, Ronald. She had no children. And about their friend, Mrs. Perkins, who was in hospital with her hip, poor dear. At midday, Mrs. Greenberg went home, and Mrs. Whittaker made herself cheese on toast for lunch. And after lunch, Mrs. Whittaker took her pills, the white and the red and two little orange ones. The doorbell rang. Mrs. Whittaker answered the door. It was a young man with shoulder-length hair, so fair it was almost white, wearing gleaming silver armor with a white surcoat. Hello, he said.
Hello,
said Mrs. Whittaker. I'm on a quest, he said.
That's nice,
said Mrs. Whittaker noncommittally. Can I come in? He asked. Mrs. Whittaker shook her head.
I'm sorry, I don't think so, she said.
I'm on a quest for the Holy Grail, the young man said. Is it here?
Have you got any identification?
Mrs. Whittaker asked. She knew that it was unwise to let unidentified strangers into your home when you're elderly and living on your own. Handbags get emptied, and worse than that. The young man went back down the garden path. His horse, a huge gray charger, big as a shire horse, its head high and its eyes intelligent, was tethered to Mrs. Whittaker's garden gate. The knight fumbled in the saddlebag and returned with a scroll. It was signed by Arthur, King of all Britons, and charged all persons of whatever rank or station to know that here was Galad, Knight of the Table Round, and that he was on a right high and noble quest. There was a drawing of the young man below that. It wasn't a bad likeness. Mrs. Whittaker nodded. She'd been expecting a little card with a photograph on it, but this was far more impressive.
I suppose you would better come in, she said.
They went into her kitchen. She made Galad a cup of tea. Then she took him into the parlor. Galad saw the grail on her mantelpiece and dropped to one knee. He put down the teacup carefully on the russet carpet. A shaft of light came through the net curtains and painted his awed face with golden sunlight and turned his hair into a silver halo. It is truly the Sangreal, he said very quietly. He blinked his pale blue eyes three times very fast, as if he were blinking back tears. He lowered his head as if in silent prayer. Galad stood up again and turned to Mrs. Whittaker. Gracious lady, keeper of the Holy of Holies, let me now depart this place with the blessed chalice, that my journeyings may be ended and my gaius fulfilled.
Sorry,
said Mrs. Whittaker. Galad walked over to her and took her old hands in his. My quest is over, he told her. The Sangreal is finally within my reach. Mrs. Whittaker pursed her lips.
Can you pick your teacup and saucer up, please, she said.
Galab picked up his teacup apologetically.
No, I don't think so, said Mrs. Whittaker. I rather like it there. It's just right between the dog and the photograph of my Henry.
Is it gold you need? Is that it, lady? I can bring you gold.
No, said Mrs. Whittaker. I don't want any gold, thank you. I'm simply not interested.
She ushered Galad to the front door.
Nice to meet you, she said.
His horse was leaning its head over her garden fence, nibbling her gladioli. Several of the neighborhood children were standing on the pavement watching it. Galad took some sugar lumps from the saddlebag and showed the braver of the children how to feed the horse. Their hands held flat. The children giggled. One of the older girls stroked the horse's nose. Galad swung himself up onto the horse in one fluid movement. Then the horse and the knight trotted off down Hawthorne Crescent. Mrs. Whittaker watched them until they were out of sight, then sighed and went back inside. The weekend was quiet. On Saturday, Mrs. Whittaker took the bus into Maresfield to visit her nephew Ronald, his wife Euphonia, and their daughters Clarissa and Dillian. She took them a currant cake she had baked herself. On Sunday morning, Mrs. Whittaker went to church. Her local church was St. James the Less, which was a little more, don't think of this as a church, think of it as a place where like-minded friends hang out and are joyful. It was more than Mrs. Whittaker felt entirely comfortable with, but she liked the vicar, the Reverend Bartholomew, when he wasn't actually playing the guitar. After the service, she thought about mentioning to him that she had the Holy Grail in her front parlor, but decided against it. On Monday morning, Mrs. Whittaker was working in the back garden. She had a small herb garden she was extremely proud of. Dill, vervain, mint, rosemary, thyme, and a wild expanse of parsley. She was down on her knees, wearing thick green gardening gloves, weeding and picking out slugs and putting them in a plastic bag. Mrs. Whittaker was very tender-hearted when it came to slugs. She would take them down to the back of her garden, which bordered on the railway line, and throw them over the fence. She cut some parsley for the salad. There was a cough behind her. Galad stood there, tall and beautiful, his armor glinting in the morning sun. In his arms, he held a long package wrapped in oiled leather. "I'm back," he said.
"Hello," said Mrs. Whittaker.
She stood up rather slowly and took off her gardening gloves.
"Well," she said, "now you're here, you might as well make yourself useful."
She gave him the plastic bag full of slugs and told him to tip the slugs out over the back of the fence. He did. Then they went into the kitchen.
"Tea or lemonade?" she asked.
"Whatever you're having," Galad said. Mrs. Whittaker took a jug of her homemade lemonade from the fridge and sent Galad outside to pick a sprig of mint. She selected two tall glasses. She washed the mint carefully and put a few leaves in each glass, then poured the lemonade.
"Is your horse outside?" she asked.
"Oh, yes. His name is Grizel."
"And you've come a long way, I suppose?"
"A very long way."
"I see," said Mrs. Whittaker.
She took a blue plastic basin from under the sink and half-filled it with water. Galad took it out to Grizel. He waited while the horse drank and brought the empty basin back to Mrs. Whittaker.
"Now," she said, "I suppose you're still after the Grail."
"Aye, still do I seek the Sangrail," he said. He picked up the leather package from the floor, put it down on her tablecloth, and unwrapped it. "For it, I offer you this." It was a sword, its blade almost 4 feet long. There were words and symbols traced elegantly along the length of the blade. The hilt was worked in silver and gold, and a large jewel was set in the pommel.
"It's very nice," said Mrs. Whittaker doubtfully.
"This," said Galad, "is the sword Balmung, forged by Wayland Smith in the dawn times. Its twin is Flambergé. Who wears it is unconquerable in war and invincible in battle. Who wears it is incapable of a cowardly act or an ignoble one. Set in its pommel is the sardonyx Bercone, which protects its possessor from poison slipped into wine or ale and from the treachery of friends. Mrs. Whittaker peered at the sword.
It must be very sharp, she said after a while.
It can slice a falling hair in twain. Nay, it could slice a sunbeam, said Galad proudly.
Well, then maybe you ought to put it away, said Mrs. Whittaker.
Don't you want it? Galad seemed disappointed.
No, thank you, said Mrs. Whittaker.
It occurred to her that her late husband Henry would have quite liked it. Oh, he would have hung it on the wall in his study next to the stuffed carp he had caught in Scotland and pointed it out to visitors. Galad rewrapped the oiled leather around the sword Balmung and tied it up with white cord. He sat there, disconsolate. Mrs. Whittaker made him some cream cheese and cucumber sandwiches for the journey back and wrapped them in greaseproof paper. She gave him an apple for Grizel. He seemed very pleased with both gifts. She waved them goodbye. That afternoon, she took the bus down to the hospital to see Mrs. Perkins, who was still in with her hip, poor love. Mrs. Whittaker took her some homemade fruitcake, although she had left out the walnuts from the recipe because Mrs. Perkins' teeth weren't what they used to be. She watched a little television that evening and had an early night. On Tuesday, the postman called. Mrs. Whittaker was up in the box room at the top of the house doing a spot of tidying, and taking each step slowly and carefully, she didn't make it downstairs in time. The postman had left her a message which said that he'd tried to deliver a packet, but no one was home. Mrs. Whittaker sighed. She put the message into her handbag and went down to the post office. The package was from her niece, Sherelle, in Sydney, Australia. It contained photographs of her husband, Wallace, and her two daughters, Dixie and Violet, and a conch shell packed in cotton wool. Mrs. Whittaker had a number of ornamental shells in her bedroom. Her favorite had a view of the Bahamas done on it in an enamel. It had been a gift from her sister, Ethel, who had died in 1983. She put the shell and the photographs in her shopping bag. Then, seeing that she was in the area, she stopped in at the Oxfam shop on her way home.
Hello, Mrs. W, said Marie.
Mrs. Whittaker stared at her. Marie was wearing lipstick. Possibly not the best shade for her, nor particularly expertly applied, but thought Mrs. Whittaker that would come with time. And a rather small skirt. It was a great improvement.
Oh, hello, dear, said Mrs. Whittaker. There was a man in here last week asking about that thing you bought, the little metal cup thing. I told him where to find you. You don't mind, do you? No, dear, said Mrs. Whittaker. He found me. He was really, really dreamy, really, really dreamy, sighed Marie wistfully. I could have gone for him. And he had a big white horse and all, Marie concluded.
She was standing up straighter as well, Mrs. Whittaker noted approvingly. On the bookshelf, Mrs. Whittaker found a new Mills and Boone novel, Her Majestic Passion, although she hadn't yet finished the two she had bought on her last visit. She picked up the copy of Romance and Legend of Chivalry and opened it. It smelled musty. Ex Libris Fisher was neatly handwritten at the top of the first page in red ink. She put it down where she had found it. When she got home, Galad was waiting for her. He was giving the neighborhood children rides on Grizel's back up and down the street.
I'm glad you're here, she said. I've got some cases that need moving.
She showed him up to the box room in the top of the house. He moved all the old suitcases for her so she could get to the cupboard at the back. It was very dusty up there. She kept him up there most of the afternoon, moving things around while she dusted. Galad had a cut on his cheek, and he held one arm a little stiffly. They talked a little while. She dusted and tidied. Mrs. Whittaker told him about her late husband, Henry, and how the life insurance had paid the house off, and how she had all these things, but no one really to leave them to. No one but Ronald, really. And his wife only liked modern things. She told him how she had met Henry during the war when he was in the ARP, and she hadn't closed the kitchen blackout curtains all the way. And about the sixpenny dances they went to in the town, and how they'd gone to London when the war had ended, and she'd had her first drink of wine. Galad told Mrs. Whittaker about his mother, Elaine, who was flighty, and no better than she should have been, and something of a witch to boot. And his grandfather, King Pelles, who was well-meaning, although at best a little vague. And of his youth in the castle of Bliant on the Joyous Isle. And his father, whom he knew as Le Chevalier Malfait, who was more or less completely mad, and was in reality Lancelot du Lac, greatest of knights, in disguise and bereft of his wits, and of Galad's days as a young squire in Camelot. At 5 o'clock, Mrs. Whittaker surveyed the box room and decided that it met with her approval. Then she opened the windows so the room could air, and they went downstairs to the kitchen where she put on the kettle. Galad sat down at the kitchen table. He opened the leather purse at his waist and took out a round white stone. It was about the size of a cricket ball. "My lady," he said, "this is for you, and you give me the Sangreal." Mrs. Whittaker picked up the stone, which was heavier than it looked, and held it up to the light. It was milkily translucent, and deep inside it, flecks of silver glittered and glinted in the late afternoon sunlight. It was warm to the touch. Then, as she held it, a strange feeling crept over her. Deep inside, she felt stillness and a sort of peace. Serenity, that was the word for it. She felt serene. Reluctantly, she put the stone back on the table. "It's very nice," she said. "That is the philosopher's stone, which our forefather Noah hung in the ark to give light when there was no light. It can transform base metals into gold, and it has certain other properties," Galad told her proudly. "And that isn't all. There's more. Here." From the leather bag, he took an egg and handed it to her. It was the size of a goose egg, and it was a shiny black color, mottled with scarlet and white. When Mrs. Whittaker touched it, the hairs on the back of her neck prickled. Her immediate impression was one of incredible heat and freedom. She heard the crackling of distant fires, and for a fraction of a second, she seemed to feel herself far above the world, swooping and diving on wings of flame. She put the egg down on the table next to the philosopher's stone. "That is the egg of the phoenix," said Galad. "From far Araby it comes. One day it will hatch out into the phoenix bird itself. And when its time comes, the bird will build a nest of flame, lay its egg, and die, to be reborn in flame in a later age of the world."
"I thought that was what it was," said Mrs. Whittaker.
"And last of all, lady," said Galad, "I have brought you this." He drew it from his pouch and gave it to her. It was an apple, apparently carved from a single ruby on an amber stem. A little nervously, she picked it up. It was soft to the touch, deceptively so. Her fingers bruised it, and ruby-colored juice from the apple ran down Mrs. Whittaker's hand. The kitchen filled almost imperceptibly, magically, with the smell of summer fruit, of raspberries and peaches and strawberries and red currants. As if from a great way away, she heard distant voices raised in song and far music on the air. It is one of the apples of the Hesperides, said Galad quietly. One bite from it will heal any illness or wound, no matter how deep. A second bite restores youth and beauty, and a third bite is said to grant eternal life. Mrs. Whittaker licked the sticky juice from her hand. It tasted like fine wine. There was a moment then when it all came back to her, how it was to be young, to have a firm, slim body that would do whatever she wanted it to do, to run down a country lane for the simple, unladylike joy of running, to have men smile at her just because she was herself and happy about it. Mrs. Whittaker looked at Sir Galad, most comely of all knights, sitting fair and noble in her small kitchen. She caught her breath. And that's all I have brought for you, said Galad. They weren't easy to get, either. Mrs. Whittaker put the ruby fruit down on her kitchen table. She looked at the Philosopher's Stone, and the Egg of the Phoenix, and the Apple of Life. Then she walked into her parlor and looked at the mantelpiece, at the little china basset hound and the Holy Grail and the photograph of her late husband Henry, shirtless, smiling and eating an ice cream in black and white, almost 40 years away. She went back into the kitchen. The kettle had begun to whistle. She poured a little steaming water into the teapot, swirled it around, and poured it out. Then she added 2 spoonfuls of tea and 1 for the pot and poured in the rest of the water. All this she did in silence. She turned to Galad then, and she looked at him.
Put that apple away, she told Galad firmly. You shouldn't offer things like that to old ladies. It isn't proper.
She paused then.
But I'll take the other 2, she continued after a moment's thought. They'll look nice on the mantelpiece, and 2 for 1's fair, or I don't know what is.
Galad beamed. He put the ruby apple into his leather pouch. Then he went down on 1 knee and kissed Mrs. Whittaker's hand.
Stop that, said Mrs. Whittaker.
She poured them both cups of tea, after getting out the very best china, which was only for special occasions. They sat in silence, drinking their tea. When they had finished their tea, they went into the parlor. Galad crossed himself and picked up the Grail. Mrs. Whittaker arranged the egg and the stone where the Grail had been. The egg kept tipping on one side, and she propped it up against the little china dog.
They do look very nice, said Mrs. Whittaker.
Yes, agreed Galad. They look very nice.
Can I give you anything to eat before you go back, she asked.
He shook his head.
Some fruit cake, she said. You may not think you want any now, but you'll be glad of it in a few hours' time, and you should probably use the facilities. Now give me that, and I'll wrap it up for you.
She directed him to the small toilet at the end of the hall and went into the kitchen holding the Grail. She had some old Christmas wrapping paper in the pantry, and she wrapped the Grail in it and tied the package with twine. Then she cut a large slice of fruitcake and put it in a brown paper bag, along with a banana and a slice of processed cheese in silver foil. Galad came back from the toilet. She gave him the paper bag and the Holy Grail. Then she went up on tiptoes and kissed him on the cheek.
You're a nice boy, she said. You take care of yourself.
He hugged her, and she shooed him out of the kitchen and out of the back door, and she shut the door behind him. She poured herself another cup of tea and cried quietly into a Kleenex while the sound of hoofbeats echoed down Hawthorne Crescent. On Wednesday, Mrs. Whittaker stayed in all day. On Thursday, she went down to the post office to collect her pension. Then she stopped in at the Oxfam shop. The woman on the till was new to her.
Where's Marie?
Asked Mrs. Whittaker. The woman on the till, who had blue-rinsed gray hair and blue spectacles that went up into diamante points, shook her head and shrugged her shoulders.
She went off with a young man on a horse. I ask you, I'm meant to be down in the Heathfield shop this afternoon. I had to get my Johnny to run me up here while we find someone else. Oh, said Mrs. Whittaker. Well, it's nice she's found herself a nice young man. Nice for her, maybe, said the lady on the till. But some of us were meant to be in Heathfield this afternoon. On a shelf near the back of the shop, Mrs. Whittaker found a tarnished old silver container with a long spout. It had been priced at 60p, according to the little paper label stuck to the side. It looked a little like a flattened, elongated teapot. She picked out a Mills and Boone novel she hadn't read before. It was called Her Singular Love. She took the book and the silver container up to the woman on the till.
65p, dear, said the woman, picking up the silver object, staring at it. Funny old thing, isn't it? Came in this morning. It had writing carved along the side in blocky old Chinese characters and an elegant arching handle. Some kind of oil can, I suppose.
No, it's not an oil can, said Mrs. Whittaker, who knew exactly what it was.
It's a lamp.
There was a small metal finger ring, unornamented, tied to the handle of the lamp with brown twine.
Actually, said Mrs. Whittaker, on second thoughts, I think I'll just have the book.
She paid her 5p for the novel and put the lamp back where she had found it, in the back of the shop. After all, Mrs. Whittaker reflected as she walked home, it wasn't as if she had anywhere to put it.
Jane Curtin read Chivalry by Neil Gaiman. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2008 by Salman Rushdie, and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, Budget Travel, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, and the Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.